Jai Guru, everyone.
Jai Guru. Welcome to the next episode of our Yogananda podcast. We are going through the autobiography of a yogi, line by line, and we are already in the middle of chapter 12 with the years at Master's Hermitage. We are actually in part two of chapter 12. So in the last chapter, Guruji arrived there, and now we get a bit more of a description of the building and about Sri Yukteswar himself, who we haven't heard that much about in the book so far. But first, how is everyone doing? I see Chris is in an interesting location again. But how is everybody?
Yeah, I'm currently in Peru, Lima, and it's nice. Currently Friday. So I'm going to look forward to try to find some SRF devotees in Lima. I'm going to be here for a few weeks and then off to Cusco for 4 weeks. So hopefully Cusco is quite big. It's 400,000 people. So I'm hoping to find some SRF devotees there as well. Do some meditation on Sunday. Looking forward to it. So shout out to anybody in Peru that's listening.
Yeah. Did you check online if there's a center in Lima?
I literally booked this as maybe Mike, you know, on Saturday, arrived on Sunday. I've been working Monday to Friday, so I haven't stopped to check, but I'm looking forward to meeting some SRF devotees in this country.
Fantastic. Yeah, I really like Chris's lifestyle, and I hope you will meet many interesting devotees over there in Peru. I've been there last year in Lima and also in Cusco. I found it fantastic, but I was more there on a short touristy trip. I didn't go to any centers, SRF centers.
Yeah. A quick search has shown me Lima in Peru, so I'm going to email them right
nice.
After this show.
Yes. Yeah. I hope your Spanish is good.
Yeah. Hablo portuguese, inglés, no, español.
There you go. That will do. Yeah. All right. So yeah, we're already in the middle of chapter 12, and in this part, Guruji describes the building of Sri Yukteswar's hermitage, and he goes into great detail about it. He describes every aspect. So as a reader, you can really imagine what this place looked like. He says like it has a flat gray roof, and he says that it looks like large and ancient, well built. So I imagine thick walls, and he also talks about the trees in the backyard and a balcony, a balustrated balcony that made me think of like a villa in Tuscany or something like that. Priyank?
What is its condition right now, Mike? Especially when you last went.
I went there last in 2012. And so what was the deal there? I think there was one of the relatives of him own it, and they are happy if you prearrange to show YSS devotees around. And what I remember from memory is you went in, and then there was a courtyard that had some plants, and it was like maybe like a square property that had like the building was like on the sides, and in the middle there was a courtyard, and there was a little statue, I think, of, I don't remember 100%. Was it Lahiri Mahashay? You probably have much better, more recent memories, Priyank.
Well, no, the reason I ask you is because you're right, it's obviously owned by the family. But when I went just last month, it was almost in a very decrepit state.
Mm-hmm.
So the family has now moved out, and YSS has been allowed to purchase the plot.
Ah, amazing.
Yeah, so now it's like an overgrown, very broken down building. But the good news is we've been told by Swami Vishvananda that after YSS procured it, now they're going to hopefully make a very big ashram there. And obviously, you'll know that there's Sri Yukteswar Smriti Mandir is adjacent on an adjacent plot. But now they're going to rebuild the whole ashram based on their pictures and video footage, like Richard Reich's video footage when Paramahansa Yogananda went there in the 1930s. And so they're going to rebuild it as it was back then, as it's described here. And they're going to, but apparently when the family had, while they owned it, they actually demolished the original building completely and built on top of it. But the existing foundations were still there now, even there, they're now. So what they're going to do is build using those plans and those foundations, and also relocate a lot of the bricks that are in the foundations to different parts of the building. So then it retains some of that Sukdeshwara vibe.
Amazing. Yeah, it's funny how sometimes, you know, you can tear down a building, but if the idea of the building is still strong, then it will, it might even come back at some point. And now I find that great that they will restore it. And that's another, I don't know when they will be finished, but it's another reason to go visit India, to go to see this. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And especially a place like Serampore. I remember the, even in its old state, I remember Serampore was a very, very busy area, like small streets, but there were so many people and all kinds of things going on in the street. And then when you walk inside, then it becomes quiet and peaceful. So, yeah, I do have to stream now that I will go there and visit it when it's done. That sounds great. I hope some of our listeners will too. Yeah, it's a great place. It has the, I think it's not that far from Dakshineswar Ashram, right? I think it's, you can do it probably like in an hour or something to get over there. Yeah, pretty great. Yeah, so we have balustraded balconies. I think that was my cue for thinking it looked like an Italian mansion. The colonnades. And then he also said that they have like a big ground floor hall where they do events. And then the main event that they're celebrating there is Durga Puja. And I've heard of Durga Puja before because I got a friend who's Bengali, and she told me about that once, that this is like the biggest festival in Bengal, where it is a religious festival, but it's also, it's like a fair. You have like booths that sell food everywhere and all kinds of parades. So it's a festive period. And Sri Yukteswar's ashram was more than happy to join in there and participate in this. Yeah, Durga Puja. That's probably also a good time to visit Bengal when that is going on. And then he also describes the furniture that they have. And I was a bit surprised because he says that he calls it even Western style chairs, benches, and tables. And when I was in India, I went to many buildings and I was missing exactly those things there. And as a Westerner, I like to sit down on a chair, sit by a table, but I was often sitting on the floor. And my, like, you get into it after a while. The first few days in India, I really felt my knees and my legs hurting from sitting on the floor all the time. But then you, after a while, you get into it. So it's the body adjusts. Priyank?
Indeed. It's hard to, I find it hard to do long meditations on the floor, but we can persevere and do it. I find that you can, well, I can seem to meditate a bit deeper when on the floor for some reason. Don't know why.
Okay.
I like the descriptions here of his ashram. I plainly furnished, everything was simple, clean, and utilitarian. You guys will obviously probably have guessed that fits my personality well.
Your lifestyle?
I like it. The other funny thing in here was that he said that that the outer walls were moss covered and pigeons fluttered over the grey flat roof unceremoniously, which hints mm-hmm. at the fact that even back then they weren't very favoured.
Yeah, he took a stab at pigeons there. Yeah, definitely. That's funny. Yeah. Also, when he describes those, Chris, do you want to go first?
Yeah, maybe you're just about to say it, Mike. So I don't want to take the wind out of your sail.
No, go for it.
Yeah.
No.
The plantain trees, the mango, the jackfruit, and these are all great trees to have around, really, to eat the fruits mm-hmm. that they have, especially jackfruit. I think in the Western world these days, it's kind of like a replacement for meat, like a meat substitute. So it's a good one for us veggies. But interestingly, something Barbara, my wife, actually said to me one day about the history of having fruit-bearing trees. It was once upon a time very, very common for people to have that in their gardens. But after some time, I think it was made popular in England not to have them because it was seen as a sign of poverty if you had to have fruit-bearing trees in your garden. Yeah, so we, in where we live in Brazil, have, you know, dozens and dozens of fruit-bearing mm-hmm. trees and stuff like that. So we've gone the opposite way. But yeah. It's just an interesting sort of moment there.
Yeah, I can tell you here in California, there is barely a house where they don't have some kind of fruit-bearing tree in the garden. And then you have neighbors who come over. Or one thing I've seen often is they, like, if they have a peach tree and then you get them all at once, right? Suddenly you have way too many peaches. And then people put the peaches in a basket and put them on their front lawn. And then you can just take as many as you want. That's something I've seen often around here. So you walk through the neighborhood the right season and then you get them fruits. Yeah.
Either that or you make gallons and gallons of peach jam.
Yeah.
Yeah. Peach jam is actually pretty great. My personal favorite, apricots. We had my sister has an apricot tree, so I'm a big fan of apricots. Apricot jam is also very good. I've made that once. It's actually pretty easy, right? You just boil them, you add a ton of sugar, and then you put them in jars. Yeah,
sugar, that's the killer. Yeah.
Why
I think this is very Sri Yukteswar-esque, let's say, is that mm-hmm. He, in the great, great book, The Holy Science, says that we are frugivores, right? So that we actually have a tract in the digestive tract that is actually more beneficial or to eat fruits. Mm-hmm. And so he's maybe living by what he preaches here. And, you know, he's got these three great fruit trees in his own garden.
One thing I find funny is that I eat jackfruit a lot, but mostly like as this hipster style meat substitute where they make like pulled jackfruit and stuff. But I've never had a raw jackfruit in my life. I don't even know what it tastes like. I've seen what they look like, but I've never cut one. I feel like if somebody throws me a jackfruit, I'm gonna die because it looks like a weapon. but I've never had a raw jackfruit before. One thing I was gonna mention earlier is when I hear the Western style chairs, benches, and the utilitarian, simple, clean way, it reminds me of the SRF retreats. They are very much furnished like that. And then they have a little bookshelf, a little bed, and you can just, it motivates you to spend your life in a spiritual way. Chris?
You know, the asana postures, there are many of them. And from what I understand, it can take a lifetime just to try to master one posture. And to Priyank's point earlier about sitting, you know, on the floor, you're presumably, Priyank, you can sit in lotus. I think you can, full lotus or semi.
Not very well, but yes. Yeah,
for a short time anyway, right? Like, but you can sit there. But that is an actual asana posture, a defined one. Whereas I don't think sitting on a chair is, you know.
What?
in the book of asanas. So maybe that's to
they forgot about that one.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You know, maybe that's why there's some sort of, you know, positive energetic flow in the body, and sitting's more beneficial.
They Yogananda gets a bit of criticism amongst traditionalists for allowing people to meditate on chairs.
Yeah.
Allowing disciples, because obviously conventional wisdom means that you have to sit in one of the asanas Chris mentioned, i.e. the half lotus or full lotus if you can manage it. But obviously Sri Yukteswar seems to have also been in favor of chairs and benches, as long as they're not, I imagine, like Western style sofas where you go in and instantly you can feel your back crane inwards, and after many decades of that position, sure your back won't thank you for it.
Are you enter sofa, Priyank? Disappointing. Yeah.
Something like that.
Guruji talks about the benefits, though, of lotus posture, and how that it actually allows for the perfect flow of energy through the body, and that in ancient times this was a way for healing, to sit in the lotus posture, because that way the body can the energy flows in a way that it can heal itself. So sorry, I'm losing my voice.
Brother Sivananda, Mike, you remember during the last last thing we had in London, you asked me to sit. I was demonstrating something, and he asked me to sit, so I just sat cross-legged. And as a joke, he said, "Look, Priyank is now demonstrating perfect Padmasana or lotus posture," and everyone started laughing because it was anything but.
That was pretty good.
I think the feedback from that, Priyank, was that everybody was in awe at your technique. So
yes,
you're leading the bunch.
Yeah,
right.
I think so. Then so he goes describing the place, the hermitage. Then he says that master invited him to stay overnight, and a vegetable curry was served, and they were sitting there with the disciples. Yes, Priyank?
Yes, they were served by two disciples who were also presumably living in the hermitage. But When I read this, I just, you know, when you have like a, if you have like a, for example, if you have an epic day, or like you've done like 10 hours of hiking or something with very little or no food, and then whatever you make at the end of the day is just like the most phenomenal meal, right? I could just imagine, like, obviously Mukunda's been through quite a, you know, journey to get here, and especially if you think about the arc of his life. So this meal, just in my mind, I can imagine him would have really enjoyed it. I just reading it, I can sense it was a fantastic vegetable curry. I was thinking, do you think he would have enjoyed it more than the feast that he had at Gorimar's house in the last episode? I think this one is obviously has more significance, so probably enjoyed it more, even if it wasn't as varied and complex as the other one was.
Yeah, I mean, company makes a big difference as well. This must have been something that Guruji very much enjoyed, his first evening, his first night at his new guru. So that is very, very special in a different way, for sure. And Guruji, he describes also how they're sitting together. He says they're like squatting on a straw mat, which to me as a Westerner sounds very uncomfortable, but I'm sure they weren't. They were doing fine. He says the friendly stars were very close, which I find a remarkable sentence. If maybe it's a figure of speech where they go, where this just means that the vibes were great, or maybe it has a deeper meaning, which is totally possible. That this was like a big moment, and everything aligned for him on this evening. Yes, Priyank?
Yeah, the straw mat is a common one amongst in India. we call it an asan. So people, if you're going to sit on the floor, you don't sit on the bare floor. You sit on an asan, and here it's a straw mat. And we know Srikdishwar has got his tiger skin. I've got a painting in my living room where there's this yogi who's doing his asanas on an asan, which is deer skin. So it varies according depending on what you're doing and who you're doing it for, and you know where you are, all those kind of things. But I've got a few asanas that I have and that we meditate on. But this star thing is quite dreamy, isn't it? The friendly stars were very close.
Yeah. Yeah. Must have been quite the moment, I think. That what this means. Quickly on the straw mats and the squatting. Like when I 5 years ago I had some issues with my sciatic nerve in my left leg. And then I got all kinds of tips from a million people, of course. Everyone is a hobby physiotherapist, including Priyank. And one of the tips I got is that squatting is really good. And so that's what I did. I started in the beginning, I could do 5 minutes and then my legs would die. And I got all the way up to 35 minutes. And for a while I did that every morning, 35 minutes of squatting. And then literally there was no blood left in my legs. It was just, I couldn't feel them anymore. How people can be squatting like in a casual way and just stay like that for hours. That is probably, if you do it from young on, the body kind of gets used to it. But I find that very hard too.
You always take it to the extreme, don't you, Mike? I'm sure that person said, you know, just do 5 minutes here and there. Like, no, 35 minutes.
You have to keep going up. If you don't go up, somebody told me that recently, that human life is like a bicycle. If you stop, you fall over. So you have to keep going forward. Yeah.
Nice. I've also when I went to an ashram that had an office in India once, and I wanted to see how their tables and chairs were, and they had a very interesting setup. They had really low level tables, like maybe 2 feet off the ground, and they had these, you know, office chairs like this, but they were like 10 centimeters off the ground, so they could move around, they could sit cross-legged on the floor and still move around and talk to each other. But they're all like, so if you stand up in the office, you can just see the tops of everyone's heads and the chest as you look down upon them like giants.
That's the Indian version of the office chair. I like that. Yeah, like did you ever, like, when you want to sit cross-legged on that office chair, what I find annoying is the armrests. They're like in the way, right? So you should somehow make them in a way you have space to.
You need fancy ones. My armrest flips to the side.
Oh yeah. Okay.
Like this. Oh, you can't see.
Okay.
If it flips round.
For the yogi mode.
Yeah. Yogi mode.
That is great.
Beast mode.
Yeah, I need mine has no armrest for that reason. Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah. I don't know why, but sometimes I like to meditate on my office chair. That's
I just did, it works for me. Just did half an hour before this call, actually.
Yeah, wherever you are, there's no wrong place to meditate. I mean, there are wrong places. But yeah,
like what are you talking
like
about?
Like while you're driving.
Oh, okay.
Not when you have a Tesla to drive for.
Right. Yeah. Great. You can pray that the Tesla
one day gonna
get you home safe. Yeah. Yeah. So Sriyukteswar, he says Guruji asks him to tell him something about his life, and then he gives him a little resume. He says his family name before, Swami Sriyukteswar is his Swami name, or but his life, his family name was Priya Nath Karar. Priya sounds a bit like Priyank, and maybe the same root. I looked it up. It says it means beloved. Does that check out, Priyank? Yeah.
Yep. Okay. Yep. That's and the only reason I know that is because someone got me with the like the name tag with the meaning with it once, and then I thought, oh yeah.
Oh, okay.
But no, the Priya, the root Sanskrit Priya means to have affection for or to hold beloved. And I used to hate my name when I was young, especially. Okay. I lived in a very English neighborhood, and in an English, very, I was pretty much the only non-English person in the school, so everyone had simple names that everyone could pronounce and spell easily, whereas mine was the opposite. So I wished for a much simpler name, so I never liked my name until I read the autobiography, and then I realized Swami Sukadeshwar has the same pre-sannyasi, nice. Pre-initiation name, and I was like, oh no, maybe it's not so bad.
It's a good name, yeah. Yeah, it's a good name. Yeah. No, I must agree. I think Priyank is a very nice name. Priya. And his middle name is Na, which I looked up and it says God Protector. It reminded me a bit of maybe that's a false friend, but it reminded me a bit like of a lot of those holy places, they end in Na. And maybe that's the same root, or maybe not. Probably, I wasn't able to verify that.
I imagine
And Karar is the, I found a few meanings for that. There was like one translation that said it means the bank of a river. And then there's supposedly also a flower that goes by that name. So, or maybe that flower grows on banks of rivers. I don't know.
His his ashram in Puri is still called Sri Yukteswar's ashram in Puri. Is called the Karar ashram. The Karar ashram.
Oh, okay.
For that reason.
Interesting. Mm. Yeah, I've never been there. That's still a place I would like to visit. Because that is also a place where we will see in this chapter that they will travel to, and Guruji will have spent time there. And then he tells the story of him growing up. His father was a successful businessman, and he had like some schooling, but he wasn't very interested, very much like we will see Mukunda, or have seen Mukunda is the same. And then he was a householder, and he was married and had one daughter.
I've got a few stories from Swami Satyananda's book.
Oh, yeah.
On his biography of Sri Yukteswar. Just as another reminder, Swami Satyananda is Guruji's childhood friend, who was also in charge of the Ranchi ashram whilst he was in the USA and the school. So he did a lot of research about all of our gurus, Swami Sri Yukteswar, our Guru Paramahansa Yogananda, and Lahiri Mahashaya, and Shastri Mahashaya actually as well. And within the biography of Swami Sri Yukteswar, it said that initially he studied science in college, but he got bored of it and then went on to study medicine. And then after the first couple of years, he felt he'd learned everything he needed to. So he dropped out and left formal education, and then went on to study on his own things like homeopathy and sports and music and astrology later on. So that was his academic background. But I found some cool stories about how he was in school. So and I think I'll tell you why it's important, because there's some relevance to it. So Lauren, if you'd like to start us off with the reading.
At that time, Priyanath went there and listened to the deliberations with full attention. Different people asked the scholar various questions on numerous subjects, to all of which he answered by giving scriptural examples. Without giving much explanation to make it understandable, with every precept he would say, "It's in the Shastras, therefore this precept should be followed." He carried on this way for quite a while. The smart youth, Priyanath, was able to easily get the pundit's attention. Along with everyone else's questions, he put in a couple of his own. But instead of elucidating, the scholar would give his scriptural quotations over and over again, which finally annoyed Priyanath to the point when he turned to some friends and said in such a way that the pundit could hear, Mahashai?
Yep.
The other day about subject, I discovered a special quote from the Shastras. It was an amazing proof.
The shloka was, Labet Bhati Gurna Prasrabane. Saying this, he quickly left the place and laughed historically with his friends and then said,
he doesn't make any effort to help us understand anything. Even when asked, he won't answer with any logic. Just a bunch of incomprehensible mumbo jumbo from the Shastras and then yelling at us, trying to make us feel stupid. I couldn't tolerate it anymore. So I composed a sloka of my own and said it. It means you will attain that thing when you go around urinating on the road. His companions were rolling over with laughter. Over in the gathering, the scholar was quiet for a moment and then suddenly said, what did you say? What sloka did you spout? Trying to make a mockery out of me. Why, you little rascal, I'll show you. By that time, Priyanth was out of reach. Later, when some people in the Goswami house would scold him about that, he would say, just a bunch of stupid scriptural exhortations. I was annoyed. Whatever it may be, shouldn't he try to explain it at least? The Sanskrit sloka that I comprised is also a scriptural precept. What's the point in explaining it?
So he invented a mock shloka. I essentially about wasting time and time wasters, you know, comparing them to those that go around urinating. But he was, yeah, so he devised a Sanskrit shloka. And we'll know, Chris will know especially from one of his favorite books, The Holy Science, Sri Yukteswar, when he, after his Swamihood, he wrote a couple of books, and one of them was The Holy Science. And in that, he has written his own and devised his own shlokas and spiritual texts. And then very beautifully, not just quoted them and translated them, but he's then explained them. So that's one of the reasons why The Holy Science is such a nice book. I also found out that as Mike mentioned, he got married, but he was a widower just pretty much straight after his marriage, just a few years, and then his wife passed away, and then his daughter got married. Don't know much about his daughter, to be honest, so if anyone's got any information about the lineage of Sri Yukteswar, that'd be good, because his daughter did actually have a child, so he was, and she was a girl, so Sri Yukteswar had a granddaughter, but also, you know, his daughter then passed away soon after childbirth, so I don't know what happened about his bloodline, but that would be quite interesting.
I wonder if there's still someone of his direct bloodline is still alive today. Interesting. I don't actually know how meaningful that is.
Probably not in
life. Might not be that meaningful, right?
But just interesting. Maybe it is.
Yeah, just interesting. Yeah,
exactly. She's probably she was probably like the granddaughter was probably the heir to the throne in terms of the inheritance of that the property in
right.
mm-hmm. in Srirampur. And maybe she's the one that sold it. Who knows?
Or that had that other building built there.
Oh, maybe.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, and then of course he says he was blessed to have Lahiri Mahashaya as his guru and have his guidance. So that was something. So he was a family man, but also a bit like most people who follow Yogananda, who follow SRF, right? Are like family, they have families, but they follow the guidance of their guru. And so he was the same. And then after his wife passed away, like Priyank said, then he had more time to devote himself. And he also even joined the Swami order. I didn't even know that was possible. I thought once you choose the life of a householder, you cannot be a Swami anymore. But you can, apparently. Maybe it just requires you not to have any obligations anymore towards the family.
He wasn't actually a Brahmin. And Swami initiation is usually reserved for people from Brahmin families, obviously ignoring the true meaning of the caste system, i.e. their qualities as opposed to inherited names and family backgrounds. But that kind of answers the question, Mike. So if being a Brahmin is a quality, then Swami Sri Yukteswar would obviously have been the highest Brahmin, right? Even though he wasn't born one. So he actually did get quite a lot of criticism and not much respect, actually, in certain circles, because he wasn't a Brahmin and became a Swami. But he found in Swami Satyananda's book, he decided to take initiation, and he went to Bodh Gaya. Bodh Gaya is a town maybe a couple of hundred miles west of Srirampur, in near the middle of India. And Buddhists will know it because that's where the Bodhi tree is, where Buddha attained his enlightenment. And he met one of the chief swamis of that area, and it said that he would initiate him, but there's a special prescript for the fellowship in which he had founded. He said that no one would be addressed as Babu or Mister. Instead, whether the name was in Bengali, English, or any other language, the prename Sri Yukta would be used. And hearing this, the Swamiji happily said, "This is a novel thing today, because when a gentleman's name is written, especially in English, it doesn't even arise in one's mind to use the Indian Sri or Sri Yukta. For this reason, I am now declaring this sacred statement as a sadhu. Let it be that your name in the shelter of a sannyasi is Sri Yukteswar Giri." It'll be, I think it's also in the footnote as well, you can't say Yukteswar. His name is Sri Yukteswar. So if you wanted to put the honorific title of Sri in front of him, his name would have to be Sri Yukteswar. So that's something that we should bear in mind.
Yeah, it sounds strange. I've never heard somebody just say Yukteswar. It's always Sri Yukteswar. And it's a nice name. There's a footnote where they say that Yukteswar means united to Ishvara. And that's the name of God, Ishvara. We probably remember in the beginning of the book, we had Guruji Mukunda meditate. He wanted to see what is behind the darkness of closed eyes. And then there was a light, and it said it was Ishvara. So we are familiar with this word already. Yeah. And then Guruji says an interesting sentence here. He says, Master smiled. And then he says, like all biographical sketches, his word had given the outward facts without revealing the inner man. So he has not really this. He says, yeah, this is your resume, but that doesn't really tell me who Sri Yukteswar really is in his life. Doesn't tell the story of the great Swami, of the great guru that he found. And then he says, I don't know if that's a common thing that you would do often. I don't think I would have ever asked that question, but he says, tell me stories about your childhood, because he thinks they would be more revealing than his resume is. And Sri Yukteswar picks him up on it and goes like, sure, I got some stories. I got some stories I can tell you. And the first story is one that is very famous among SRF devotees. I heard that many times. I heard it many times during talks, because it has to do with fearlessness and the fearlessness of Sri Yukteswar. Yes, Priya?
Yeah, going back to your point about that you wouldn't think to ask him about his childhood. Mm-hmm. Imagine you're just trying to uncover more, get him to speak more. you gotta just get information out of him and get teachings out of him. I imagine in that context he may have just, you know, mm-hmm. he was in awe of his guru there, meeting him. This is only his second meeting, of course. But I love that Sri Yukteswar didn't just, oh, I was born here and then he didn't go on a half an hour arc, you know, storytelling arc, because it's so easy to do that, isn't it? No, he just gave like a paragraph about his life, and he said such are my simple annals, right? And then Guruji asks him essentially to elaborate more, you know, stories from your childhood, and he doesn't then go for even further into detail. He says each one I'll tell you will have a moral. So he's not even just saying it for the sake of it. He's saying it because everything that he utters is essentially a teaching and meant for his realization.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and some people would have answered the question about his life very differently. I remember my grandma, whenever I asked her, tell me about your life, she was like, you know, I was like, she told me about doing her PhD and she became a lawyer, and she was like one of the first female lawyers in Austria, and that was amazing. Yeah. I mean, accomplishment, it's a very, very, it shows off pride in the worldly accomplishment. Yeah.
Is that your dad's mum that you're talking about?
Yes. Mm. Yes. Yes.
Thought so. I was in a meeting yesterday, departmental mm-hmm. meeting. Everyone had 2 minutes to just speak a little bit about themselves. And mm-hmm. how many people do you think stuck to the 2 minutes? And this is a particular thing that I get frustrated about. So when I started, I put my phone on a timer and I showed everyone, right? And then I finished at 1:45, and I said, see, everyone that follows, please can you respect the time. What I didn't say was no one really cares about hearing 5 minutes about
life. Did anyone adopt your method, Priyank, or did they
just... let me think. Yes, a couple did, but the rest just carried on with their usual ways. So no matter how clear and obvious and, you know.
This is a real exercise in like managing your ego, I think, when somebody tells you, tell me about your life. And they're like, okay, finally, somebody asked me. That's right. That's right. Yeah. And did you know this about me? Yeah. Yeah.
I know we're talking anecdotal now, but I actually heard just the other day that it was talking about children and how they need attention. Mm-hmm. And the idea was that there is no ability to differentiate attention from love when you're a child. Mm. And that, to me, I thought, okay, that is interesting, because, you know, if you give a child enough attention, the child feels, you know, attended to and loved. But then maybe this might be no different what we're talking about, that Sri Yukteswar is much more mature, that he knows he doesn't need this. Mm-hmm. He doesn't need to garner mm-hmm. attention by talking about his life, because he's got love from a different source. But
Yeah. And it's, I think what Priyank said earlier, it's also true that Guruji just wanted to get him to talk because he was in awe, and he just wanted to get wisdom and knowledge out of him, and that was probably a way to do it. And let's get into the ghost story, right? Like his mom told him about a ghost in a dark chamber, and I remember my dad telling me that story, and when I was a kid, and I was not on the same page with Sri Yukteswar. But he was like, there's a ghost, where is it? And then he opened all the closets and started looking for the ghost, and was very disappointed not to see the ghost, which is, I think, the purpose of a ghost story usually is to frighten the child a bit. And I don't even know why parents do that. It makes actually no sense. But yeah, completely backfired.
I actually recall something similar in my childhood. My older siblings or cousins or someone was trying to scare me with this in this similar way. And with my curiosity inclined mind, I couldn't not see it. So he, Sriyukteswar, as a child, or Priyanath, he was doing it because he wanted to see the ghost, essentially. And he said he expressed his disappointment at having missed the ghost. Whereas us, me immortals, like myself, when I did this, I was shaking in my boots. But I knew I had to just, you know, uncover it one way or the other. I needed to know if there was a ghost there. But I was horrified, as most of us would be when we're confronted with that kind of thing.
Yeah, and that's a completely natural reaction, in my opinion. But Sriyukteswar was a special child who, as an avatar, I feel like you don't really have to go through the same stages as a kid where you're frightened by everything, but he was fearless from the beginning. Should we go to the next story?
No, we haven't gone to the moral.
What's right, the moral? The moral is to look fear in the face and it will cease to trouble you. Yeah.
It's a good moral, isn't it?
Yeah.
I wonder, is it something that's like become an actual saying now? This. I wonder if
at least amongst devotees, but yeah, it could be could have spread already. Yeah.
Yeah, I feel like it's like when I read it, I remember it wasn't like this is a new teaching. It feels like this is a philosophy that has filtered into the mindset of the common man, and then through to me somehow. This I also have another story from the Swami Satyananda's book about something similar. So whenever he would encounter people claiming to have supernatural powers or being able to conjure up miracles, then he would then immediately go and see if it's true. So Chris, if you can find this out. So this is one such person that made some claims about his capabilities, and Sriyukteswar's response.
I used to often hear from his devotees and his disciples that every night their Gurudev would sit still in Yogasana and in midair. After arguing back and forth, when those devotees began to spread the word of that event even more, one evening, being extremely careful, I silently lay down under the bed of the yogi, Sadaka Mahasaya. From time to time, I thought that it could be maybe his supernatural work was true. But since it was not possible to prove it in any way, let me satisfy my curiosity in hiding. At the proper time, the yogi Bhara entered the room, closed the door, and laid down. Time passed on, staying completely quiet under the bed. Eventually, I became restless. Finally, I lost my patience and said, "What? You didn't float up in the air?" The yogi Bhara hurriedly got up and said, "Oh, you are right under the bed, you punk. No wonder my samadhi wasn't good tonight." After that, laughter exploded inside and outside. Fantastic. Yeah. It actually reminds me of a story I heard just last week, that one of the talks that we shared in the episode from last week, and I'll try to find it actually when I'm talking, but I think it was maybe Swami Ishtananda Giri said it, was that Guruji, no, it wasn't him actually, I'll try to find the name, but Guruji was in the ashram, and one of the brothers had heard that a true avatar would not cast a shadow. And so the brothers were saying, well, you know, if our guru was a true avatar. He, you know, he wouldn't cast the shadow. And then so every time that, you know, Guruji would come out to see them and talk to them, you know, the brother, this particular brother, was saying, right, I'm going to look for the shadow this time. And every time, you know, day after day, this went on for weeks, he would forget. And then eventually he thought to himself, well, this isn't a coincidence that I keep forgetting. You know, why is it that I keep forgetting? You know, obviously Guruji has something to do with this. And so time goes on, and Guruji essentially knows exactly what's going on, and he interacts with the brother, and kind of with a twinkle in his eye, makes a comment to say that a true avatar can choose to display certain abilities and not display them, and looked his brother directly in the eye with, you know, a bit of a laughter twinkling in his eye. And at that point he knew exactly, like, he had been played for the past several weeks. I'll get that story because it's a lovely one, actually. Maybe link it in the description.
Yeah, I've heard it a couple of times. It's a nice one.
Yeah. That seems to be also an ability by avatars sometimes to make you forget something in the moment. That's a story, a funny story, that we will hear later from Swamiji Yukteswar about this and Babaji. Let's go to the next door. Oh yeah, Lauren.
Before we go on, just on fear, it just came to my mind to look in the Bhagavad Gita, because one of my favorite chapters is chapter 18, and it's the qualities that make man godlike, and the first one is fearlessness. So I just thought I'd read just a couple of bits out because they're really lovely. Okay, it says, fearlessness is mentioned first because it is the impregnable rock on which the house of spiritual life must be erected. Fearlessness means faith in God, faith in his protection, his justice, his wisdom, his mercy, his love, his omnipresence. Fear robs the man of the indomitability of his soul, disrupting nature's harmonious workings emanating from the source of divine power within. Fear causes physical, mental, and spiritual disturbances. Fear ties the mind and heart feeling to the external man, causing the consciousness to be identified with mental or physical nervousness, thus keeping the soul concentrated on the ego, the body, and the objects of fear. The devotee should discard all misgivings, realizing them to be stumbling blocks that hinder his concentration on the imperturbable peace of the soul. The devotee must strive even harder to divert his attention by infusion of his conscious mind with thoughts of courage. Further, and most important, he should confide himself completely into God's trustworthy hands. To be fit for self-realization, man must be fearless.
Wonderful.
So, go look fear in the face.
Yeah. It is one of those, I feel like there's a lot of things on the spiritual path that aren't like, you know, there's not like not one thing you need, but there's multiple things. It's like fearlessness isn't everything, but without it, you're not going to get there, right?
Yeah.
Same with loyalty, and same with a few other qualities.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I guess fear comes essentially from our humanness, from us being identified with the body. As a soul, there isn't anything to fear, the way Guruji explains it. So makes sense. Yeah, very nice. Thank you for reading this.
Sorry.
The second story is one that I found, I don't know, wouldn't have been my cup of tea, but as a kid, Sri Yukteswar got obsessed with a neighbor's dog who he describes an ugly dog. So, and then you can imagine him, avatar with strong willpower. He said he kept my household in turmoil for weeks because he wanted this dog so badly. And it didn't really manifest in the end. But he says the moral of the story isn't, it is basically that attachment is blinding. So once you develop an attachment, you might, the way I understand it at least, is you want something more, even though it's not really something you want or need or that it should be desirable at all. But the way he describes it here, it adds an imaginary halo of attractiveness on the thing. So beware of your attachment, beware of getting attached, especially to things, because then you might not be a good judge of their of how important they are for you in your life anymore.
I can relate as well, because you know, when if you really want something really badly, that thing starts looking really more and more attractive, doesn't it? It could even be a person, right? Especially when you're young. And then after you get that thing, then you realize that it was as exactly as he's described, the imaginary halo of attractiveness is an imaginary one, because you create it and you build it up so much in your own mind that you'd lose perspective, and then your mind's just tricking you into thinking this is the be all and end all. When you get it, you realize, oh gosh, I can't believe I was this crazy about this, and now I can finally put that to bed. And then you'd think that you've learned your lesson. Like next time, next time you'll be
on this now. You'll know
better. Yeah. Then you go through the same thing again. Such as the delusory and the pull of Maya, isn't it?
I think one thing that also adds an attractiveness is when you can't have the thing. So I remember as a kid, when I went through a toy store or something like that, with all kinds of things I wanted. And I remember for Christmas, sometimes when I got something that I wanted for so long, there was like this moment. It was just a moment, unfortunately, but it was this moment where I felt like, finally I have that thing now. Mm-hmm. And then it's like Priyank said, it's imaginary. It goes away. And now when you're an adult, I don't know if you guys feel the same way. Now you could buy all the things that you see in the store and stuff, and you know none of them will give you any joy, so you just don't go for it.
I remember I could extend this story actually with Sriyukteshwar. I can imagine, like, especially me when I was a child, when especially the toy thing, Mike, that's a good example. I would like tell my mum to try and convince her to make buy it for me. Was that I'd be like, this is the only thing I'll ever ask for. I'll never ask for anything ever again. That's how delusional you become, and then you realize, oh my gosh, I can't believe I said that about this, if you do actually end up getting it.
I used to do this a lot with pets as a child. This was my thing. You know, it was either rabbits or hamsters or a cat. And I literally, like Sriyukteshwar, I would plague my family. I'd write them letters, you know, make a child happy today, buy me a cat. And, you know, it would go on for weeks until I either got it or I didn't. It's true, once you get it, it's like, well, then you're dawned with the realization that you have to look after said thing, right? So but yeah, it's a funny one, what we can, our minds can get so attached to, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's amazing to read it in a book like this, that this is actually a spiritual principle that we should be wary of. Yeah. So I'm sure deep down we as an adult, you kind of know this, but it's really good to know of this principle and keep on top of those kind of things in your life. Don't let them take you over. Yeah. Absolutely. And let's go to story number three. Story number three, I found interesting because it's a bit twofold. It's like it's like his mom, she gave him an advice, which I found interesting. We can talk about this. And then also he talks about how important it is to give smart, right counsel to children early on, because it is character forming for them. It really makes a big difference. Once someone is an adult, you can still give them counsel, but it might not be as useful or as fundamentally helpful anymore as it is for children. That's the point that Yogeshwar here makes. And then the counsel that his mom gives him is that a man who accepts a job under anyone is a slave. And I don't know, I'm on a payroll at a company, and I think most of us are, right? So it is nice to not have that and to be an entrepreneur and successful. And but I never saw it that drastic. But I don't think it's something I would say I will prove this wrong here. I say yeah, this is an interesting point of view. Yeah.
You know, I'll never forget the day that my dad said to me, "Chris, no matter if you're a successful businessman or a busman, you know, as long as you're happy." Because my dad would be a successful businessman, but his brother is a busman, you know, my uncle. And he just basically was saying the moral of the story is don't worry about any of that. If you're happy, that's the main thing. I don't know if I've actually enacted that truly to the extent that I probably should have, but it's a great lesson.
There's a British saying that is similar to this, so it must be a British paradigm that his mom is parroting. So it's like, I remember when I started with my company, and I was speaking to my school friends, and they said, you work for the man. Which essentially just means your basically life has snared you, and you now are just a pawn in the plan of, like, you know, society, whereas they're like outliers. Chris,
like the song, "All in All, It's Just Another Brick in the Wall."
Right.
Another Brick in the Wall is I think that was quite popular in, I don't know, late, what's it, 90s or something, that kind of concept. A bit rebellious.
And he says that it left such an indelible mark on his life that even after his marriage, he refused all positions. And Swami Satyananda, in his book, in the Bhagavad Gita, he says that when his Sri Yogeshwar's father passed away, his father had quite a lot of businesses. And Sri Yogeshwar then naturally became, you know, in charge of all those businesses. But he, for whatever reason, he wasn't that into it. So those businesses didn't do well. And he had to, those companies ended up folding. And then it says, like, he met his family expenses by, you know, investing in land and doing that kind of stuff. So, like, this plasticity of the mind, of the youthful mind, is something that we should all be careful of, even Sri Yogeshwar.
Yeah. And I can identify with this. I remember there was a time when I took my parents' advice as gospel. And that is really something, even now that I'm older and I make my own decisions and everything, but deep down in the foundation of my thinking, I know some of those pillars, they are from those days, and they are hard to dislodge now. They are just there. So it really, really is impactful.
It is an interesting subject, this in general, if you think of what Yogananda said about the subject of working. And he said enough on it, really, of substance that shows his perspective quite clearly, which is serve, be of service, and put God first, and have that channel be of service to your boss, to your company, should you work, and make that your highest goal, because we all have a place in time, in order to serve mankind. So that's his position on it. He doesn't say anything remotely like this, but simply put, he says, be of service to your family. If you have a family, make sure that you have enough coming in to provide for them. So, you know, it's a bit more agnostic as to exactly how you do that, as opposed to what's quite clear, you know, what Sri Yukteswar is telling him, how he led his life. So circumstantially different, but Yogananda was held a quite different position.
You know that saying, do what you love and you'll never have to work another day in your life. Do you guys ascribe to that philosophy?
Not really.
Yes.
No, I don't at all. Lauren, be the vote winner here.
Well, to be very dry about it, even if we're doing what we love, we're still working, right? But we can either work with joy and gratitude or work with a heavy heart, right? So it's still work, but it's
3-1, Chris. What's your defense?
I'll defend my position by saying this. I think in the essence of the statement is to say that you should follow your true passions in life and try to bring the most joy, you know, in what you do. And people maybe have different motivations for taking work. And I think that's partly what it is as well. Like, don't chase money. Because when I grew up, everybody wanted to be a lawyer, doctor, you know, whatever, because of how much money could I earn. They looked at the kind of average earnings, and that's a pretty bad way of doing it. So you might end up in a bit of a pit of despair eventually, because you're not following God's plan for you as an individual. Unique, as Sri Yukteswar says, we're all unique. That's beautiful. So if you sort of try to mold yourself to somebody else's will, and, you know, that's not truly what is in your nature, which is our true nature is love. So it's more along those lines. I think all points are maybe valid.
Well defended. Well defended.
Yeah.
Didn't think you could come out of that hole, but you said
yeah. Yeah. You were pinned against the wall and you fought your way out.
Gurji's blessing, of course.
I think one reason why I don't like the saying is because it kind of gives a bad connotation to work. And I don't think that it should have that. I actually like working and I want to like working. If I'm in a place where I hate working and then it's definitely the wrong place. But then when I like my job, then I'm quite happy to do work and enjoy it, because I feel like it's very good for your balance, your life, your everything. It makes you stronger, and it improves your willpower and makes you happy at the end of the day.
I think it also, that saying then gives an excuse to a lot of people that aren't necessarily doing what they would like to be doing to not do it well. So that's one of my biggest gripes in the office, when people are moaning about their job rather than being positive and enjoying what they do. Because I think there's very, very few jobs out there that justify hate, you hating it or being completely miserable. The vast majority of the jobs are fulfilling a purpose, whether it's, you know, high and mighty, like, you know, in government, or whether it's sweeping the street. It's essentially doing the same thing, right? But it's all in your mindset and how you look at life and service and your highest duty, not to necessarily your immediate employer, but, you know, as a citizen in the kingdom of God. So I really find it hard when hearing negativity in the workplace, and this is one of the reasons why it's rife.
Isn't the story in the autobiography when Guruji meets a butcher who's enlightened, And he talks to the butcher, like, you know, hey, why are you doing this job?
different book, Chris.
I think that's a different, yeah. I know where you've got that from.
Yeah. Sorry, I was going to say, it's a different, yeah.
Different story, yeah.
If you know the story, but the moral, maybe there. Where you do with God in mind.
Yeah. You
know? But people don't do that in society is the thing, yeah.
Mm. Yeah, we should work for God, and that makes it changes the whole perspective. However, there's a fantastic talk by Muktimata on self-esteem out on YouTube that you guys should watch. It's really talks about the importance of finding your calling. It's about, you know, there's your soul or your mind came incarnated to do something specific. It's not anything. You have to find the right thing that resonates with you. And if you don't do that, you will feel sad. And she says that. And so it is true that any job can be done with pleasure and with the right attitude. But it's also important that we look into ourselves and journal and find what the right thing is for us.
Yeah. I have to say, I have experience with that, what you're talking about, Mike. You know, for years I did other various jobs, and I was so disheartened by it. I obviously tried my best. I worked very hard, but you know, I'd be going to work and I'd be crying in the toilet because I knew that it just wasn't what I was meant to be doing. I didn't know what that was, but I knew that, you know, what was out there, what I was currently doing wasn't it. So I think it's true, you know, there's doing our work, whatever we've been placed in, and doing it to the best of our ability and, you know, doing it well. But like you said, there's also going within, isn't there, and realizing, okay, well, this isn't working, and what can I do? And having faith that will come if we just persevere and have faith.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I fundamentally believe that. And I think, like many things in life, the good things, they come to you if you just keep at it.
Yeah.
And yeah, there is a small reading I got from the Divine Romance. And that's about back to the neuroplasticity of children and the importance of giving children right habits early on. I think we just need the first paragraph. I think that would be enough. Priyank, would you be able to read that?
Cool. Train children to develop a preference for right habits. In this modern age, everyone needs to be trained because they have so much temptation placed before them. All parents should train their children to develop a taste for better habits. Consider more seriously the responsibility of guiding your children. Many bad habits are imposed on them in the environment of schools. Influenced by other children, they feel they have no choice. If someone doesn't join the crowd and smoke or drink, he is considered a sissy. Youngsters thus can succumb to all kinds of wrong behavior. I know so many boys and girls who have taken to drink and smoking, and even worse. When those young children that I have taken into the ashram for training, I consider my own, and my heart goes with them. My heart goes out with them when they go into the environment of the public schools. I tell them, don't be a doormat. Dare to be different. And to say no when others try to persuade you into wrong ways.
Mm. I should use that in schools. I'll tell my children that. Don't be a doormat.
Don't be a doormat.
<That's> great. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, so, because I think of that sometimes. One of my sister's roommates has a young one, and I love playing with them, and And but sometimes I forget that I'm so much older, and whatever I tell them stays with them for a long time, right? Mm. Because you're an adult, and they play around, but they also take you very seriously. That it really makes a difference what you say and how you say it. And it's really a chance to, there's like this unfinished masterpiece still, right? And you can do a little bit of the chiseling there, right? So mm-hmm. It's always a good opportunity. Yeah, and then as so often, Dryukteswar fell into tranquil silence. And then around midnight, he led him to, I would say, his sleeping quarters. And yeah, that was day one at the Hermitage. That was it. Yeah. Very, very nice how Gurchi describes in detail what they were doing. Yes, Chris?
Whenever I was reading this, I thought, it's true to Guruji's nature, isn't it? He's right in there with the questions. He's not just simply, you know, sitting back, you know, having a day of silence or something, observing. And you know, he really wants to get to know his Guruji as quickly as possible. Day one, you know, he's asking about his childhood, about his life, and sort of pressing him, which I find very endearing. You know, he's just endlessly curious and, you know, wants to know as much as possible as quickly as possible. But first day and quite a momentous turning point really in his life, Guruji.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like you said, the positive stars, they felt near on that day, so must have been a really momentous day for Guruji. And we said that many times, it was a bit of a turning point in this autobiography, because he finally found his guru at his hermitage. So this is the end of part two of chapter 12. There's many more parts to come. I think we split into 20 parts, so quite a bit more to come. Does anyone want to add anything, or do you think we've done justice to this part? Yes. All right, then I want to thank the listeners and the viewers on YouTube and Jai Guru.